readers, welcome back to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I'm so glad we're sharing this time together. The holidays are behind us, and perhaps we can finally find some quiet moments to settle in with a good book. Maybe you've received a gift card or two over the holidays, and you're looking to use it on a few good titles. Say no more. It's my raison d'etre to offer up choices you'll enjoy. This week, I'm going to take you coast to coast on an entertaining literary quest. We'll get started right after this.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Start in the Big Apple with comedian Steve Martin taking aim at New York's highbrow art scene in his An Object of Beauty. Lacey Yeager is young, captivating, and ambitious enough to take the New York art world by storm. Groomed at Sotheby's and hungry to keep climbing the social and career ladders put before her, Lacey charms men and women, old and young, rich and even richer, with her magnetic charisma. Her ascension to the highest tiers of the city parallel the soaring heights and at times the dark lows of the art world and the country from the late 1990s through today. Steve Martin has a meticulous eye for detail and nuance. Many readers applaud his ability to write women characters so convincingly. An Object of Beauty is a well-observed and well-described glimpse into a world that few of us have the money, time, or life experience to enter. Campbell Scott narrates.
I am tired, so very tired of thinking about Lacey Yeager. Yet I worry that unless I write her story down and see it bound and tidy on my bookshelf, I will be unable to ever write about anything else. My last name is Franks. Once in college, Lacey grabbed my wallet and read my driver's license aloud, discovering that my forenames are Daniel Chester French, after the sculptor who created the Abraham Lincoln Memorial. I am from Stockbridge, Massachusetts, where Daniel Chester French lived and worked, and my parents, being parochial Americans, didn't realize that the name Daniel Chester French Franks read funny. Lacey told me she was related to the arts by blood, too, but declined to tell me the full story, saying, "Too long. Later I'll tell you, French fries." We were 20. I left Stockbridge, a town set under the glow of its even more famous citizen, the painter of Glad America, Norman Rockwell. It is a town that is comfortable with art, although uncomplicated art, not the kind that is taught in educational institutions after high school. My goal, once I discovered that my artistic aspirations were not accompanied by artistic talent, was to learn to write about art with effortless clarity. This is not as easy as it sounds. Whenever I attempted it, I found myself in a convoluted rhetorical tangle from which there was no exit. After high school, I went south to Davidson College in North Carolina, while Lacey drove north from Atlanta, and there Lacey and I studied art history and had sex together exactly once. Even at the age of 20, Lacey's entry into the classroom had the pizzazz of a Broadway star. Our eyes followed her down the aisle, where she would settle into her seat with a practiced hair flip. When she left a room, there was a moment of deflation while we all returned to normal life. It was apparent to everyone that Lacey was headed somewhere, though her path often left blood in the water. If one of her girlfriends was in a crisis, Lacey would rush in, offering tidal waves of concern. She could soothe or incite in the name of support, "Honey, get over it," or conversely, "Honey, get even." Either bit of advice was inspiring. The emotions of men, however, were of a different order. They were pesky annoyances, small dust devils at her feet. Her knack for causing heartbreak was innate, but her vitality often made people forgive her romantic misdeeds. Now, however, she is nearing 40, and not so easily forgiven as when her skin bloomed like roses. I slept with her in our second year. I was on the rebound, and managed to avoid devastation by reconnecting with my girlfriend days, or was it hours, later, and Lacey's tentacles never had time to attach. But her sense of fun enchanted me, and once I had sufficiently armored myself against her allure by viewing her as a science project, I was able to enjoy the best parts of her without becoming ensnared. I will tell you her story from my own recollections, from conversations I conducted with those around her, and alas, from gossip. Thank God the page is not a courtroom. If you occasionally wonder how I know about some of the events I describe in this book, I don't. I have found that, just as in real life, imagination sometimes has to stand in for experience.
When the crash of the U.S. stock market became public knowledge in the fall of 2008, it was already old news to some. According to Michael Lewis in his The Big Short, Inside the Doomsday Machine, the real crash, the silent crash, had taken place over the previous year. Where? In bizarre feeder markets where the sun never shines and the SEC doesn't dare or bother to tread. The bond and real estate derivative markets, where geeks invent impenetrable securities to profit from the misery of lower and middle class Americans who can't pay their debts. The smart people who understood what was or might be happening were paralyzed by hope and fear. In any case, they weren't talking. The crucial question is this: who understood the risk inherent in the assumption of ever-rising real estate prices, a risk compounded daily by the creation of those arcane artificial securities loosely based on piles of doubtful mortgages? Michael Lewis turns the inquiry on its head to create a fresh, character-driven narrative brimming with indignation and dark humor, a fitting sequel to his number one best-selling Liar's Poker. Who got it right, he asks. Who saw the ever-rising real estate market for the black hole it would become and eventually made billions of dollars from that perception? And what qualities of character made those few persist when their peers and colleagues dismissed them as chicken littles? Out of this handful of unlikely heroes, Lewis fashions a story as compelling and unusual as any of his earlier bestsellers, proving yet again that he is one of the finest and funniest chroniclers of our times. Let's listen as Jesse Boggs tells the tale.
When I sat down to write my first book, I had no great agenda, apart from telling what I took to be a remarkable tale. If you'd gotten a few drinks in me and then asked what effect the book would have on the world, I might have said something like, I hope that college students trying to decide what to do with their lives might read it and decide that it's silly to phony it up and abandon their passions or even their faint interests to become financiers. I hope that some bright kid at Ohio State University who really wanted to be an oceanographer would read my book, spurn the offer from Goldman Sachs, and set out to sea. Somehow that message was mainly lost. 6 months after Liar's Poker was published, I was knee-deep in letters from students at Ohio State University who wanted to know if I had any other secrets to share about Wall Street. They had read my book as a how-to manual. In the 2 decades after I left, I waited for the end of Wall Street as I had known it. The outrageous bonuses, the endless parade of rogue traders, the scandal that sank Drexel Burnham, the scandal that destroyed John Goodfriend and finished off Solomon Brothers, the crisis following the collapse of my old boss John Merriweather's long-term capital management, the internet bubble. Over and again, the financial system was, in some narrow way, discredited. Yet the big Wall Street banks at the center of it just kept on growing, along with the sums of money that they doled out to 26-year-olds to perform tasks of no obvious social utility. The rebellion by American youth against the money culture never happened. Why bother to overturn your parents' world when you can buy it and sell it off in pieces? At some point, I gave up waiting. There was no scandal or reversal, I assumed, sufficiently great to sink the system. Then came Meredith Whitney with news. Whitney was an obscure analyst of financial firms for an obscure financial firm, Oppenheimer and Company, who, on October 31st, 2007, ceased to be obscure. On that day, she predicted that Citigroup had so mismanaged its affairs that it would need to slash its dividend or go bust. It's never entirely clear on any given day what causes what inside the stock market, but it was pretty clear that on October 31st, Meredith Whitney caused the market and financial stocks to crash. By the end of the trading day, a woman whom basically no one had ever heard of, and who could have been dismissed as a nobody, had shaved 8% off the shares of Citigroup and $390 billion off the value of the U.S. stock market. 4 days later, Citigroup CEO Chuck Prince resigned. 2 weeks later, Citigroup slashed its dividend. From that moment, Meredith Whitney became E.F. Hutton. When she spoke, people listened. Her message was clear. If you want to know what these Wall Street firms are really worth, take a cold, hard look at these crappy assets they're holding with borrowed money, and imagine what they'd fetch in a fire sale. The vast assemblages of highly paid people inside them were worth, in her view, nothing. All through 2008, she followed the bankers' and brokers' claims that they had put their problems behind them with this write-down or that capital raise with her own claim. You're wrong. You're still not facing up to how badly you've mismanaged your business. You're still not acknowledging billions of dollars in losses on subprime mortgage bonds. The value of your securities is as illusory as the value of your people. Rivals accused Whitney of being overrated. Bloggers accused her of being lucky. What she was, mainly, was right. But it's true that she was, in part, guessing. There was no way she could have known what was going to happen to these Wall Street firms, or even the extent of their losses in the subprime mortgage market. The CEOs themselves didn't know. Either that or they're all liars, she said. But I assume they really just don't know. Now, obviously, Meredith Whitney didn't sink Wall Street. She just expressed most clearly and most loudly a view that turned out to be far more seditious to the social order than, say, the many campaigns by various New York attorneys general against Wall Street corruption. If mere scandal could have destroyed the big Wall Street investment banks, they would have vanished long ago. This woman wasn't saying that Wall Street bankers were corrupt. She was saying that they were stupid.
Social media, it's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow. Social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
I was fortunate to meet author Dagoberto Gilb at the recent Miami International Book Fair. Gilb is one of the leading voices from the American Southwest. I know I really enjoyed his book, The Last Known Residents of Mickey Acuna. His other works include The Magic of Blood and Woodcuts of Women. Gilb was born in Los Angeles. His mother, a Mexican who crossed the border illegally, and his father, a Spanish-speaking Anglo raised in East L.A., his parents divorced before Gil began kindergarten. In college, Dagoberto studied philosophy and religion and earned both a bachelor's and a master's degree. After his studies, he worked construction, migrating back and forth between L.A. and El Paso. For the next 12 years, he worked as a journeyman carpenter. In 1977, Gilb, who himself was taking a stab at writing, was working on a construction site at the University of Texas. He learned that writer Raymond Carver was teaching across the campus. Under Carver's influence, Gilb began writing short stories, and his first collection was published in 1982. Since then, he has been creating extremely original works. Welcome, Dagoberto.
Thank you so much for inviting me. That's real nice.
Well, I loved reading your book, The Flowers. First question, could The Flowers have been set elsewhere in the United States? Could it have been a Honduran-American story, a Cuban-American, Venezuelan? Could that be substitute for Mexican-American, or is that something very specific?
Very specific, I think, because, I mean, if you know the American Southwest and Los Angeles, you know that Mexican and Mexican-Americans are part of that demographic, the community of Los Angeles. It is Los Angeles.
Yes.
And, you know, I mean, the character is an indigenous part of Los Angeles. A lot of people still think that Mexican-Americans, Chicanos, are somehow, you know, mostly immigrants we get discussed as when we hit the media, but we have been here for over 200 years. And in Los Angeles, it's definitely the history of the city is Mexican-American.
Yeah. I just think it would translate amazingly into a movie. Are there discussions on that?
I have them all the time. I just don't know who's listening to me, and, you know, I don't know if I'm, you know, going on in my own head. You know, it's one of those delusional conversations they tell me I'm not supposed to have, but I often am having, and the producers are loving it whenever I have that discussion, and then I walk away, and no check arrives.
Well, I'll be looking forward to the movie. You've had such diverse work experience. Did you always know you had books inside you?
You know, some people, you know, especially poets, but I don't limit myself to them, they say, oh, when I came out the womb, I immediately wanted to write the womb poem. And they were demanding a pen from their mother. Me, no. I was much more older. I was very slow with that. I thought of, first there was mother and mommy, and then there were girls, and then there were cars, and then sometimes I had to hit in a fight now and again. But mostly, no. It was one of those things that came upon me late.
What age, actually?
Actually, I started reading after high school. I learned about novels in college, mostly as a form of distraction. I studied philosophy at some point. Finally, I got into philosophy, and I read Dostoevsky and et cetera, that kind of lit. And college was it. And I didn't start writing officially until I was in my later 20s.
Who were the writers that most influenced your work?
Well, there we go. I always start with Dostoevsky, and whenever I get this question, I like to name every Nobel Prize person you can think of, because as soon as people write that down, I figure if you Google my name, I'm next to Ionesco or Beckett, I'll look good. But having said that, it was Beckett and Dostoevsky, Camus, all the European mostly. It's funny, when I think of like Thomas Hardy or something like that, the lit, you know, all the smart kids read, I would like, no way. What is a Tess of the D'Urberville? I had no idea.
Something about strawberries in the movie.
And I also didn't understand, when I did look at them, I didn't understand what language they spoke. I just had no relationship to that language. I read a lot of the Latin American boom writers, of course.
By boom, what do you mean?
Well, we're talking about Garcia Marquez, even Vargas Llosa. That era was in the late 70s, early 80s, that we started seeing the major books from the Latin American era being translated. And, of course, you know, the Garcia Marquez was amazing. It was a breakthrough. But at some point, I have to say, and I hate to admit it, but I wasn't until I read Jack Kerouac, and of course thought he was a Chicano like me.
Which book specifically? I've read a lot of his.
I actually read a lot, but I don't remember what the first one was. It might have been, God, I want to say Lonesome something. It was a small book. And then I just heard the voice, and then I went through them all. But mostly it was until I heard his voice and I thought, that dude isn't from L.A., you know. Who is that guy? And then he had the issues that I really didn't care for. I didn't like that he'd sleep with a black girl and write a novel, and he'd sleep with a Mexican girl and write a novel. And I'm like, what the hell is that about, dude? And then what I took away from there was that you could use a real voice, a human voice, a unpunctuated voice, an ungrammatical voice, and really the kind of voice that I have of a real human being. And I also understood that a lot of the books that I'd seen people reading, including the Thomas Hardy, they were rich people.
Oh.
And I understood, oh, it's because that's actually how they talk.
Oh, well, how do you think the Hispanic community is perceived in America's society today versus 20 years ago? Has there been a dramatic shift?
I suppose it's better. And one of the things, I think the Hispanic community, I think it was Latino, and in the Latino range, we've definitely increased. We have Judo Diaz now, and Sandra Cisneros has definitely gotten on the map. But given that Mexican-Americans are two-thirds of the demographic, I mean, we're talking about two-thirds, even up to 70% of Latinos are Mexican-Americans. In fact, you don't know that. Here we're talking in Miami now, and Cubanos, they have a lot of political clout and get a lot of attention because it's the East Coast. We in the West, we do not get that attention, and Chicanos, Mexican-Americans are unknown still. We basically are having just the same problems we had in 1970, 80, and 90, getting attention. There is one, Sandra Cisneros gets quite a bit of attention because of her work crosses age groups. You know, it can go to elementary school, and not all of us right that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think in that respect, in the respect that Latino demographic has increased, we do see more in terms of Mexican Americans. I'm sure that most of your audience hearing this doesn't know who I am. And I actually have done fairly well in terms of quantity and in terms of prestige and in terms of national awards and honors and publications. In the New Yorker and stuff, but when we're still kind of outside the mainstream, and it's very strange for me because we're not an immigrant group, and in my case, I'm 100% not an immigrant.
Right. How does your new book, The Flowers, reflect current perceptions of Hispanics?
Ooh, that's a very good question that almost makes me, stop. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know in the sense that I wasn't writing it with that in mind, but I actually was trying to bring up in a non-historical way, one way we think of Los Angeles and the country is in a binary of black and white. And we think the country is, and the version after the colonial period was a civil war. And we have been stuck in that 100-year cycle of the Civil War. Or is it more than that? Get my basic math.
1865.
of a binary of black and white. But I want to include brown. I say when you talk about us, when you think of the South, for instance, you think of black and white. You always think of one. White people might say it's the South is white. And black people think of the South as black. But the Southwest, if you flip it, is an image. The Southwest, the American Southwest, and much of the West is brown and white. And yet somehow that is unknown. And we know that there's tacos and enchiladas, and we know that there's the architecture of the Southwest that everybody adores is from Mexico. We know that. We know that the reason it's called California is because there was a language there. We know that the Rio Grande and the Sierra Madres and all these, the mountains, the rivers, everything is named that way because there's a culture that has existed previous to the founding of the country. And what I try to do in that book is sort of bring in us, the Mexican American people, into a world where we see our point of view during what would seem to be a black-white riot. There's actually this other person with his concern.
Hmm. What projects are ahead for you?
Well, I have a book of stories coming out in a year, I guess. I'm about to turn it in next week, and I'm looking forward to that. I did that, I've had sort of a strange year. And so I had a novel. I was on a novel that I'm still working on, and I'm hoping that I'm going to get a new novel done in the year after this. I can't wait. I'm on that right now.
Oh. Well, thank you so much. I can't tell you, readers and listeners, how much I enjoyed The Flowers. Pick it up as soon as you can. You're going to really enjoy it also. Thank you, Dagoberto.
Oh, thank you so much.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Gilb's latest work, The Flowers, is the story of Sonny Bravo, a young Mexican-American who comes of age and falls in love while sweeping the decks of an apartment building named The Flowers, where he lives with his mother. With a habit of stealing small sums of money from the tenants' apartments, Sonny can't help entangling himself in the lives of others who call The Flowers their home. And when the neighborhood explodes with racial violence, Sonny is forced to decide what he truly values. Here is The Flowers, read by Ramon de Ocampo.
Say, like when you hear music and it gets inside your brain and goes, sticking there. And so I guess it got in mine like that. I listened and watched until I stopped getting too stupid because, I had to leave and get out of there fast. And once I got up, shook it off and remembered where I really was, even if I opened their refrigerator, when I looked inside, wasn't like I didn't think of eating or drinking. I didn't take even a soda, thirsty as I might have been. I didn't want them to know I'd been there. Though I kind of opened the fridge door because maybe I do think of, like orange juice. It's that I like orange juice. So maybe when there was some orange juice, I might have taken a gulp or two. But see, even then, nobody'd really know. One time I was in this one house, and I was looking inside a drawer in this girl's bedroom. I knew about her because she was this dude's older sister, and she was in junior college. It was that there were a bunch of bras, and I picked them up and looked at them, touched them, because I was holding them. Wasn't like I never seen my mom's and my sister's. It wasn't like I didn't know the difference. And it was the only time there was something like that, swear. And I did stop, and yeah, I still got jumpy about it and felt like it was f***ed up real bad of me. And afterward, I only snuck into one more house. Like I said, I didn't know what I was doing it for, and it wasn't like I liked doing it. I heard this because she was on the phone and I listened to her. It was her sound, a white, ripply line right into the black. Not above, Maybe below. I don't know. I think it was Nellie she was talking to, probably. That was who she talked to. That's who, I thought. My mom was going like, "What can he do?" And, "So what?" he screamed. "Listen to me," she said. "No, listen to me. No, listen. Listen." And I listened to what I could. I saw the white ribbon curling and swirling. "Men," she kind of laughed. "He will never know," she said. I know," she laughed. She said, "He is a man, and I didn't ask for that." She was laughing, but not laughing happy, and I'm listening, and I'm like going to that somewhere else inside my head, all by myself. I got worried I was getting sent to juvie when I did have to go to the court because of nothing, for so much less. That was this time when the police scraped the tires of their black and white against the curb ahead of me. I was walking by myself. At first, I didn't believe it was about me, but that policeman kept wanting to know what I was doing. I was not wanting to say. Okay, maybe. Even really, I was scared, like anybody, and I didn't want to show it, but probably I did. How was I supposed to answer, because what did I do? I was just walking, you know? Maybe a couple days earlier, I pocketed a chocolate bar and I folded a baby comic book down my pants. It wasn't like the first time I did that. And when I did get caught this one and only time, when a drugstore man yelled something, I ran. And I never made it back to that store again, and that was the worst of it. And that already was back then. And no way anyone could still care or remember. So the passenger policeman, who came up to me first, he goes, "So what are you doing?" And I'm like, "Walking on the street, mister." Which is when the driver policeman comes around to stand next to his partner, and he frowns at me too, like I'm stinky. Until a second or so later, he gets this expression on his face. His eyes go a little up to the sky, and his body gets kind of stiff, and he blows this fat old pedo. And so, like anybody would, I laughed. I did because it was funny, right? And so, yeah, I'm guilty of laughing. But that's when they both get all blowed up mad. I'm disrespectful, and I got attitude. And who did I think I am? They got so close into my face, I thought they were going to kick the crap out of me. And so that's why I had to go to the juvie court, to hear a commercial about disrespecting the police and authority, and to hear about all the potential trouble I was going to be in if I didn't go right and good boy, straighten out and care about school and my education and get good grades. My mom had to be there with me, too. She had to take off from work and listen and act like she was all worked up about me, too, which she wasn't, I knew it. Because I heard her talking all the time on the phone about what she was up with.
Are you ready for another thrill ride with Jack Reacher? Number one New York Times bestselling author Lee Childs follows the electrifying 61 Hours with his latest Reacher thriller, Worth Dying For, a story that hits the ground running and accelerates to a colossal showdown. There's deadly trouble in the corn country of Nebraska, and Jack Reacher walks right into it. First, he falls afoul of the Duncans, a local clan that has terrified an entire county into submission. But it's the unsolved case of a missing child, already decades old, that Reacher can't let go of. The Duncans want Reacher gone, and it's not just past secrets they're trying to hide. They're awaiting a secret shipment that's already late, and they have the kind of customers no one can afford to annoy. For as dangerous as the Duncans are, they're just the bottom of a criminal food chain stretching halfway around the world. For Reacher, it would have made much more sense to keep on going, to put some distance between himself and the hardcore trouble that's bearing down on him. But that's just not what makes this guy tick. If you're up for some great suspense, reach for this title, read by Dick Hill.
But the old place had endured, warping slowly, rotting slowly, leaning and weathering. All around it was an apron of ancient blacktop that had been heaved by winter frosts and cracked by summer sun and laced with wiry weeds. The main door was a slider built of great balks of timber banded together with iron, hung off an iron rail by iron wheels, but the gradual tilt of the building had jammed it solid in its tracks. The only way in was the Judas hole, which was a small, conventional door inset in the slider, a little left of its center, a little smaller than man-sized. Eldridge Tyler was staring at that small door through the scope on his rifle. He had been in position an hour early, well before dawn, a precaution he considered prudent. He was a patient man, and thorough, and meticulous. He had driven his truck off the road and followed winding tractor ruts through the dark, and he had parked in an ancient three-sided shelter designed long ago to keep spring rain off burlap fertilizer sacks. The ground was frozen hard, and he had raised no dust and left no sign. He had shut down the big V8 and stepped back to the shelter's entrance and tied a tripwire across it, made of thin electric cable insulated with black plastic, set shin high to a tall man. Then he had walked back to his truck, and he had climbed into the load bed, and he had stepped on the roof of the cab, and he had passed his rifle and a canvas tote bag up onto a half-loft built like a shelf under the shelter's peaked roof. He had levered himself up after them and crawled forward and eased a loose louver out of the ventilation hole in the loft's gable wall, which would give him a clear view of the barn exactly 120 yards north, just as soon as there was light in the sky. No luck involved. He had scouted the location many years before, the first time his four friends had called on him for help, and he had prepared well, driving in the nails for the tripwire, pacing out the distance to the barn and loosening the louver. Now he had once again gotten comfortable up on the half-loft, and he had kept as warm as he could, and he had waited for the sun to come up, which it had eventually, pale and wan. His rifle was the Grand Alaskan model built in America by the Arnold Arms Company. It was chambered for the .338 Magnum and fitted with a 26-inch barrel and had a stock carved from exhibition-grade English walnut. It was a $7,000 item, good against most anything on four legs, better than good against anything on two. The scope was by Leica, a $900 ultra-vid with a standard crosshairs engraving on the reticle. Tyler had it zoomed through about two-thirds of its magnification, so that at 120 yards, it showed a circular slice of life about 10 feet high and 10 feet across. The pale morning sun was low in the east, and its soft gray light was coming in almost horizontal across the dormant land. Later, it would rise a little and swing south, and then it would fall away into the west, all of which was good, because it meant even a target wearing a brown coat would stand out well against the brown of the faded timber box all day long. Tyler worked on the assumption that most people were right-handed, and therefore his target would stand a little left of center so that his right hand, when extended, would meet the handle in the middle of the Judas hole's narrow panel. He further figured that a man who was stiff and hurting would stand in close to limit his required range of movement to what was most comfortable. The door itself was less than 6 feet high, but because it was inset in the larger slider, its lower edge was about 9 inches above the grade. A man 6 feet 5 inches tall had the center of his skull about 73 inches off the ground, which in terms of the vertical axis put the optimum aiming point about 6 inches below the top of the Judas hole. And a man who weighed 250 pounds would be broad in the shoulders, which at the moment of trying to open the door would put the center of his skull maybe a foot and a half left of his right hand.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MAGICBUZ.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Years, legendary broadcaster Alistair Cook brought America to the rest of the world with incomparable wit and wisdom. Alistair Cook's America is his classic personal history of America, guiding us through centuries of changing life in the USA. Beginning with his own arrival in America as a graduate in the 1930s, Alistair Cook discusses the explorers who put their newfound land on the map, the pioneers who tamed the West, the soldiers who fought for independence, and the tycoons who built fortunes. From the Mayflower to the Gold Rush, the Jazz Age to Pearl Harbor, Cook keeps us listening with figures as varied as Buffalo Bill, John D. Rockefeller, and Martin Luther King. I think you will salute Cook's defining portrait of America, read by Peter Marinker.
During the First World War, I was a small boy in Blackpool, a seaside town on the northwest coast of England, which was then the summertime mecca of the cotton workers of inland Lancashire. It had hundreds of boarding houses and a stretch of sand on which it was possible to drill thousands of soldiers, since it was 6 miles long and, at the low tide of the Irish Sea, as much as half a mile wide. The town accordingly became a vast cantonment, and pretty soon after the United States declared war in 1917, the doughboys arrived. We had 7 of them billeted on us. I learned much later that the men who wrote the American Constitution put in a clause expressly forbidding the billeting of any soldier in a private house. But the Founding Fathers, with their uncanny foresight, saw to it that this prohibition did not apply to England. I thus had the experience, extraordinary in those days for a provincial middle-class boy, of encountering in the flesh the legendary tribe of the Yanks, who were known to us only through the silent and often baffling antics of Buster Keaton, Mary Pickford, and William S. Hart at the so-called Picturedrome. The Americans moved in like a football team invading a hospital. For by the autumn of 1917, all the vigorous British conscripts had come and gone from Blackpool, and very many of them were already rotting on the fields of France. They had been succeeded by the last scrapings of the barrel, the old and the chronically frail and sick. All the C-3s, once confidently labelled as unfit for combat and assigned to the auxiliary service of the Royal Army Medical Corps, were now being desperately trained as warriors. To these brave crocs, most of whom would very soon go the way of their comparatively healthy predecessors, were added the Blue Jackets, a legion of the halt and the maimed, who would today be categorized by the Pentagon as impaired combatant personnel, but in those honest days were known as wounded soldiers. The melding of these convalescents with the bouncing Americans was not easy. Cynical or crippled veterans of Ypres and the battles of the Somme did not take warmly to eager-eyed youngsters from Iowa and Illinois who announced they had come to win the war so long and inconclusively fought by the British and the French.
Known as
the mayor of Castro Street, even before he was elected to the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, Harvey Milk's personal life, public career, and final assassination reflect the dramatic emergence of the gay community as a political power in America. The Mayor of Castro Street, The Life and Times of Harvey Milk by Randy Schiltz, is a story of personal tragedy and political intrigue, assassinations at City Hall, massive riots in the streets, the miscarriage of justice, and the consolidation of gay power and gay hope. Harvey Milk has been the subject of numerous books and movies, including the Academy Award-winning 1984 documentary, The Times of Harvey Milk, and the 2008 movie Milk, starring Sean Penn. But Randy Schiltz's background as a reporter served him well in writing this book. He goes in-depth and exposes the ugliness from all quarters, leaving nothing behind. If you're a student of modern American history, this is a must-read. This compelling history is narrated by Mark Vitor.
August 1947, a sweltering Sunday afternoon. Election years routinely forced the politicians to fend off charges that New York City had become a haven for prostitutes and perverts. The cadre of police moving lazily uptown through Central Park on that sultry afternoon were of little concern to the families lolling about the meadows. The husbands eyed their children briefly before laying back down to sun their bare chests, their heads propped on rolled-up undershirts. Minutes later, in the more isolated sections of the park, where men eyed each other instead of children, the police descended with methodical swiftness, as they had so many times before. By taking off their shirts, these men were technically guilty of indecent exposure. This is a public place. 17-year-old Harvey Milk trembled as police shunted him and the other homosexual men toward the paddy wagons. Across the meadow, Harvey saw the equally shirtless family men nodding grimly at the thought that their children had been romping so close to deviance. Young Milk was bewildered but not angry as he stepped into the dark paddy wagon. Anger had no place among homosexuals of those years, only fear. Not only fear of the police, but fear of himself and of his secret being revealed by an afternoon's routine police action. Harvey was lucky that day. Police often didn't bother to lock up their quarry, just put a little fear of God in them. Glimpy Milch, Harvey's other name. Glimpy was for his unlikely appearance, the big schnoz, flappy ears, and oversized feet that early on made him look like some character from a Walt Disney cartoon. Milch was the surname he always considered his. It was the name his grandfather Morris had when he emigrated from Lithuania, Harvey told friends later. Milk was merely the English translation. The urbane, goateed Morris Milk earned Harvey's early admiration. Through peddling up and down Long Island, Morris acquired enough to open Milk's Dry Goods in Woodmere in 1882, a business that rapidly grew into the largest department store on the island. The Milk patriarch clearly knew how to get things done. Barely enough Jews lived in Woodmere for a minyan, the quorum of Jewish males necessary to hold a service, but Milk helped organize the area's first synagogue, Beth Israel. Years later, his widow even traveled to Palestine to choose the cornerstone and escort it back to Beth Israel's groundbreaking. When the local Rockaway Hunt Club did not let Jews join, Morris Milk and his fellow Jewish burghers simply started their own. But the second of Morris's six children, William, was not destined to be a pillar of the community. Bill worked some time at the store, then drifted out west to work as a cowboy, later enlisting in the Navy to serve on a sub crew during World War I. The spirited Minerva Carnes did not know exactly what she would do with her life when the Great War broke out, but she knew it wouldn't be traditional. The lively Brooklyn girl wasn't about to sit around knitting while the guys saw all the excitement, so she trotted down to the Navy Enlistment Office on October 10, 1918, and signed up as one of the first Yeomanettes, the pioneers of the Women's Navy. After the war, both Bill and Minerva returned to their disparate New York lives, not entirely settled. Minnie kept striking an independent course. She nearly lost her stenographer's job when she saw a Clara Bow movie and raced to the stylist to get one of the first bobbed hairstyles in Manhattan. Fortunately, half the steno pool bobbed their hair within 2 weeks. Bill was back working at his dad's store in Woodmere. By now, he was distinctively forthright with an irritating penchant for a loud laugh, at best. At worst, he was temperamental and tactless. Measuring in at 5'2" and 106 pounds, the brown-eyed Minnie was no match in size for her future gangly husband, but her sharp wit let her hold her own against Bill's tantrums during their courtship. From their marriage came 2 sons, Robert Milk and, 4 years later, Harvey Bernard Milk, born May 22, 1930, at Woodmere General Hospital.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
We're going to end our cross-country journey in Hollywood with a little bit of Texas thrown in. This time together is 100% Carol Burnett, funny, irreverent, and irresistible. Carol Burnett is one of the most beloved and revered actresses and performers in the U.S. The Carol Burnett Show was seen each week by millions of adoring fans, and it's won 25 Emmys in its remarkable 11-year run. Now, in this time together, Carol really lets down her hair and tells one funny or touching or memorable story after another. Listening to it feels like sitting down with an old friend who has wonderful tales to tell. In engaging anecdotes, Carol discusses her remarkable friendships with stars like Jimmy Stewart, Lucille Ball, Cary Grant, and Julie Andrews. She shares the background behind famous scenes, like the moment she swept down the stairs in her curtain rod dress in the legendary Went with the Wind skit. And then there are those things that could only happen to Carol. Those include the prank with Julie Andrews that went wrong in front of the First Lady, the famous Tarzan yell that saved her during a mugging, and the time she faked a wooden leg to get served in a famous ice cream emporium. This look back allows us to cry with the actress during her sorrows, rejoice in her successes, and finally, always to laugh. Ellen DeGeneres shares, "I grew up watching Carol Burnett. She's an amazing actress, talented writer, and legendary comedian. She inspired me to do what I'm doing today, and believe me, if I knew how to read, I would definitely read this book." But perhaps Billy Crystal says it best. Carol was a huge star on television because she was funny, daring, and always genuine. We loved Carol because we felt we knew her. With this book, we do. She trusts us with her personal anecdotes, happy, sad, hilarious, and poignant. Thank you, Carol.
My grandmother, Nanny, and I were at the picture show. I hadn't reached 2 digits yet in age because I distinctly remember my feet couldn't touch the floor of the movie house. Nanny and I were still living in San Antonio, Texas. My mama and daddy had gone ahead to California, where Nanny and I would later wind up. The feature had just begun, and his face lit up the screen. I couldn't take my eyes off him. He was talking to a beautiful lady in a nightclub somewhere, and I'm not sure what the movie was even. It didn't matter. He had a kind of crooked smile and spoke with a soft... what kind of voice was it? A drawl? The camera followed him as he stood up. You could see how very long his legs were, and I was sure his feet never had trouble reaching the floor. Skinny as a string bean, Nanny said. After the picture show, we went home to the old house, and I couldn't get the man in the movie out of my mind. He wasn't just an actor like all the others I'd seen in picture shows. This man was different. He spoke to me. I tried to explain this to Nanny. Nanny, I know that man. What do you mean you know him? I just do. He's my friend. We just haven't met yet. That's nice, dear. Drink your Ovaltine. Go to bed. Years later, in Hollywood, it was 1958 to be exact, I received a call from film director Mervyn LeRoy. He'd seen me in a couple of appearances on television and asked if I would meet with him. I was in my early 20s and just getting started, so naturally I was thrilled by his interest. He suggested that I come out to the Warner Brothers studios the next morning and meet him on the soundstage where he was shooting a movie. Why don't you get here a little before lunch, he said, so you can watch us shoot a scene. Well, I'd never been on a real movie set. I owned one decent suit, one good pair of stockings, and one pair of resoled high heels. My purse didn't match, but it was all I had, and I took the bus to Burbank. The studio guard had my name on his list and pointed me towards the soundstage. I waited for the red light outside, which meant keep out, to stop spinning. It stopped. A bell rang, and I walked into a huge cavern. Cameras, lights, cables on the floor, ceilings as tall as skyscrapers, and catwalks everywhere you looked. At the far end of the stage, I saw a small set. It was up on a rolling platform about 2 feet off the ground. And it was an office, a desk, one chair, a filing cabinet, and a door. The stagehands were securing it under the spotlights. Mr. LeRoy came over to me and introduced himself. Glad you could make it, Carol. We just have a small scene to do before we break. Shouldn't take long. He motioned me to a chair out of the way and then yelled, okay, let's go for one. An actor climbed up onto the set and took his place behind the desk. Mr. LeRoy called out to another actor behind the set door. You ready, Jimmy? All set back here, Merv. Oh, the voice. I knew it immediately. Oh, my Lord, I am in the same space as my idol. Mr. LeRoy called, action! And Jimmy Stewart walked through the door and presented a badge to the man at the desk, and that was it. End of scene. Cut! That's a print. The movie they were shooting was the FBI story. Lunch was called, and Mr. LeRoy asked me if I'd like to meet Jimmy. Oh, he was still up on the set, and Mr. LeRoy gave me a helping hand as I climbed up onto the platform. We were introduced. I was inches away from the face I had loved since I was a very little girl. He smiled, and he said he was glad to make my acquaintance. He shook my hand, he looked into my eyes, and he seemed in no hurry to go to lunch. What was it about him that drew me to him in such a deeply personal way? I admired other actors. I was a big fan of a lot of them, but there was something about him that was different. I felt it every time I saw him in the movies, and now here he was. What I'd seen on the screen was amplified 100 times in person. The warmth, the humility, the humor, the heart. Well, a lump popped up in my throat, signaling the beginning of tears. Overwhelmed, I knew I had to get out of there before I started to cry. I felt like an idiot.
Who do I think I am? Guess I don't know. Readers, I'm so glad we've had this time together. I hope you've had a laugh. And no, we didn't sing a song or two, nor will we. Let's get the gang together again next week at the same time. I'm Elaine Charles, and keep turning those pages. This has been The Book Report. Bye now.